Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay. Sarasamvada, he continuing. Yesham Veshwara Kalpana Nasti Teshamapi Shastra Syat Yarvagjana Kritatwena Prasidatwad Anadya Vichinna Veda Pralopana Bhuyishta Vittitwena Nadi Siddha Varnashama Lopi Charitriena Varnam Chatam Tam Nijanadina Vilupyaiva Swagostishu Sampadanina Charvachina Twinaiv Avagatvat Tatkinap Yadunaivo Tapitam Ityevasputam Ayati. Okay. As for those who do not accept the idea of God, and who think that very recent persons composed the revealed scriptures, they act in ways that aim to obliterate the eternal unbroken authority of the Vedas and obscure the eternal principles of Varnashrama. Thus they establish their own social divisions in their communities, obscuring the Varnas by introducing their own diets and so on. In this way, they come to the notion that the revealed scriptures are recent creations, obviously promulgated by a person of their own time. So we're not going to take them too seriously. Commentary. As described by the Vedas themselves, Varnashrama is the eternal social system that organizes human society rationally for cooperative progress and ultimate spiritual perfection. The Varnas are the occupational divisions of society: teachers, priests, teacher priests, rulers, producers of wealth, and workers. The ashramas are the stages of life aiming at gradual liberation: student life, married life, retired life, and renounced life. When human civilization becomes atheistic, the Vedic principles of Varnashrama are perverted, although in fact these divisions are natural and can never be completely avoided, even in a classless society. Corruption appears in deviations from the natural principles in eating, keeping clean, and controlling sex for good progeny and spiritual advancement. Prabhupada discusses that the word Nastika in the tradition, Vedic tradition, actually means someone who doesn't accept the authority of the Vedas. We normally understand it to mean atheist, but the real crucial division, dividing line, is whether you accept the authority of the Vedas. And if you don't accept the authority of the Vedas, you will not accept the standard system of Varnashrama social organization. You'll substitute some other way of organizing your society. That marks you as a Nastika. So even here, Jiva Goswami is placing great emphasis on the fact that these deviant people don't follow the Varnashram system. Therefore, you can't expect that anything they do or say is going to be reliable. Okay, I'll continue. Now there's a Purvapaksha, an objection raised by these same people. Nanu Vedepi Gravanak Plavante Mridabhavid Apo Bruvan Ityadi Darshanad Anaptatvam Iva Pratiyate. But we see in those very Vedas such statements as the stones float and the ground and the water spoke, which seem to indicate that the Vedas are unreliable, just for saying such ridiculous things. Here's the answer. Uchyate. karma visheshangi bhutanam gravnam viryavardhanaya stutiriyam. Sacha Sri Rama kalpita setu banda dao. Prasidatvena yatavad eve nadoshaha. Tata. I think Itava doesn't have a hyphen. I'm sorry, I've got to take a minute to make a note. I know it's a little thing, but... Okay. Again, we answer. Oh, I didn't read the whole thing. Itavad eveti nadoshaha. Tata midabavid apo bruvan ityadau tad tad abhimani devataiva vyapadishyate iti geyam. We answer, such praise of stones is meant to increase the potency of stones that serve a role in a particular ritual. This is indeed feasible, since it is well known that the same sort of praise of stones occurred in contexts such as the bridge building organized by Sri Ram. Thus such praise is faultless. And we should understand that such statements as the ground and the water spoke refer to the demigods presiding over those elements. Okay, so we can justify the Vedas statements aren't absurd. There's an explanation for them. Commentary. As mentioned in the Sri Paramatma Sandarbha, third Sandarbha, Anuchet 17, the Vedas teach Mahimna stuyamana deva viryena vardante. By being praised for glorious qualities, the demigods grow in power. So when you're praising the stone, you're not really talking to a dead stone. You're still, again, you're talking to the demigods involved. Maybe not the demigod of the stone, but the demigod who's going to do something to the stone for you. Ah, okay. We're done with the Sarvasamvadini for text 10. So now we can go back to the actual Sandarbha. What directory is it in? Well, why don't you find it? Find file number 2. You can leave this open for now. I think too. Let's see. Now we start text 11. It's a short text, but has a very long Sarvasamvadini, difficult Sarvasamvadini section. Yes. Mir, why not?
We answer, such praise of stones is meant to increase the potency of stones that serve a role in a particular ritual. Can you give an example? In a particular ritual?
I don't know the stone part. Like I mentioned the other day, you have to use a certain clay pot for holding the milk that you're going to offer to Indra in the Pavargya ceremony. So it's not supposed to be an ordinary pot. And ordinary pots are made by low-class people, and therefore what they produce is contaminated. It has to be purified by mantras and by sprinkling. But the mantra also turns the pot into a transcendental pot or a divine pot. And you chant the mantra, the priest of the Yajurveda says, "O pot, you are the womb of Aditi. You are the womb of the earth." If you're going to offer milk to Indra, you should offer it from the womb of Aditi. You're praising the pot. You're also turning the pot into something else by praising it. You're giving it sacrificial potency. I won't say spiritual, but yogic potency. It turns an ordinary clay pot that's been touched by a shudra, or a pot maker, and you've turned it into a pot fit for offering the milk to Indra. By chanting the praise, it's not just praise, but it's also a magic formula that transforms the pot. Okay? I don't know many examples. I know a few. Any other questions before we move on to 11? Okay, 11. Now, what did 10 say? Let's go back to 10 because 11 begins by saying this is upheld by statements. Well, let's go back and see what's upheld. 10 was also short. Let's read 10 again. The text of Anucheda 10. Tatastani na pramana niti anadi siddha sarva purusha paramparahasu sarva laukika alaukika jnana nidana twad aprakrita vachana lakshano veda eva smakam sarvatita sarvashraya sarva achintya ascharya svabhavam vastu vividishatam pramanam. Therefore, these are not reliable sources of valid knowledge, all the other pramanas, and shabda pramana that's not perfect. We want to understand that object which transcends everything, which is the shelter of everything, and whose wonderful nature no person can conceive or imagine. For this, our source of knowledge can only be the Vedas. The Vedas consist of non-material sound, and they alone should be our pramana, because they are eternally self-manifest, and from them have issued all departments of knowledge, mundane and spiritual, among all schools of human thought since time immemorial. Okay, that was 10. Basic point is, to understand the transcendental reality, we need to accept the Vedas as our pramana. Okay. Now 11. Tachanumatam tarka pratishtanat ityadau achintya kaluye bhava natams tarkena yojayet ityadau shastra yonitwad ityadau shutes tu shabda mulatwad ityadau pitrideva manushyanam vedas chakshus taveshvara shreyas tranupalabdher ter sadhya sadhana yorapi ityadau cha. This is upheld by such statements like these. 1. Because logical conjecture is never conclusive. That's Vedanta Sutra. Then, things inconceivable cannot be explained by logic. That's Smriti, that's Mahabharata. Next, because scripture is the source of knowledge about it, and there's more to it, but that stops there. That's Vedanta Sutra. And because the revealed scriptures say otherwise, and knowledge of the Supreme is derived from transcendental sound. That's an answer to some Purvapaksha, but we don't need to deal with it here. I think I mentioned in the commentary. And this statement, for the forefathers, demigods, and human race, O Lord, the Vedas are your own perfect eyes. They are the best instrument for seeing what cannot ordinarily be perceived, and for ascertaining the goals and means of progressive life. Now, this is Uddhava speaking, isn't it? I'm missing a reference here. Maybe it got deleted. Well, I just have to make a note. I had to make sure it's in the manuscript. Okay. So these statements make the points that Anuman is never conclusive, but Shastra, Vedas, is the source of knowledge about the Absolute Truth. basically those 2 points. Commentary. The Vedas have no human author, but among human beings, the most universally respected authority on the Vedas is Srila Krishna Dwaipayana Vyasa, who is recognized as an empowered literary incarnation of God. Just prior to the beginning of this Kali Yuga, 5,000 years ago, he edited all the texts of the Vedas for use by the less intelligent people of our age. For this he earned the title Vedavyasa, editor of the Vedas. In addition, as his personal contribution to Vedic understanding, Vyasadeva composed 2 great works, the Vedanta Sutra and the Mahabharata. Why don't I list the Bhagavatam also? It's eternal, yeah. He didn't write it. Okay. But he did write the Vedanta Sutra and the Mahabharata. The Vedanta Sutras, this is new BBT standard. We call it Vedanta Sutras, plural. Because usually in Sanskrit it's plural, Sutran and Vedanta Sutrani. To be consistent with that, although we used to say Vedanta Sutra. Usually the Buddhist books, they write sutras. They write a book called This or That Sutra. But they don't mean the same thing by it. It's not in sutra form. So it's the Buddhist, it's really the Buddhist usage to make sutra singular. The whole book is a sutra of some sort. But when you have a collection of sutras, that should be plural. At least that's our new standard in VBT. The Vedanta Sutras are a systematic commentary on the philosophical Vedic teachings found in the Upanishads. In the Vedanta Sutras, Vyasadeva proves that the Vedas present a consistent focus, samanvaya, on one goal, namely realization of the supreme truth, Brahman. What could the word samanvaya literally mean? What does anvaya mean? Logical or syntactic connection. Some anu e. I'm sorry, anu e. What about adding some to it? What does that do? Well, it's the logical coherency of the whole Vedas. Complete logical connection, not just between words in one sentence, but all the Vedas together are consistent about what they talk about. It's not that they propose opposing philosophies, inconsistent philosophies. It's all consistent. The idea of the absolute truth in the Vedas is one and consistent, not many different theories. Even though it says in one place, prana is the absolute. Another place, that akash is the absolute. It seems to contradict. So Vyasadeva takes all these apparently contradictory statements and reconciles them. That's what he does in the first chapter of the Vedanta Sutra. It's the Samanvaya chapter, showing the consistency of the Vedas. He, Vyasadeva, treats opposing views to a refutation, delineates various spiritual practices for achieving association with Brahman, and describes their sublime results. So where does he do that? Those 3 things. In the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th chapter of the Vedanta Sutras. 2nd chapter, he refutes opposing philosophies. It's called Avirodha chapter. No contradiction, because we contradict all the contradictions. 3rd chapter is sadhana pada. Sadhana jaya. The chapter about sadhana, how to practice. Usually, it's mostly in the form of meditations. Meditational worship is what's taught in the Upanishads, vidyas or upasanas. And 4th, the pala or prayojana chapter, what is the result gained by the practice. Those are the 4 topics of the 4 chapters of the Vedanta Sutras. Let's finish the purport first. Okay, go ahead. samanvaya, the consistency of the Vedic message. Yes, avirodha. Avirodha. No kind, you know, defeating all the opposing views. Three, the sadhana, and four, the pala. The means and the end. The practice and the goal, the achievement. Four topics. Continuing, the Mahabharata is an epic history, primarily dealing with the civil war of the Kuru dynasty at the time of Sri Krishna's appearance, and including narrations on hundreds of varied topics. The chief heroes of the Mahabharata are the five ideal sons of Maharaj Pandu. Lord Krishna is often present, but for the most part, he stays in the background, allowing his devotees instead to be in the center of the drama. To substantiate the proposition that the Vedas are the most perfect source of Shabda Pramana, that's a mistake. Okay, their source of Shabda Pramana. I guess you could say that. Sri Jiva Goswami here cites Dvaipayana Vyasa's own opinions from these two works. That means Mahabharata and Vedanta Sutra. We have quotes from both in the Anuchet. Plus a statement from another preeminent Vaishnava, Uddhava. Tarka Pratishtanat is part of an argument in the second chapter of the Vedanta Sutras, the defeating all the other opposing philosophies chapter. There, an opposing claim is being considered that the absolute truth can be discovered by logic. In answering that view, the sutra implies the unspoken words. Implies these unspoken words. No, logical conjecture is not sufficient for realizing the Supreme. The sutra doesn't have those words. If you try to understand the Vedanta Sutras without a commentary, it'll be very tough. Practically nobody can do that. Because how do you know that these words are implied? Commentary tells you. How do you even know what part of the Upanishads, what statement in the Upanishads is being discussed? You have to be told in the commentary. Okay, so it has those unimplied words, unspoken implied words. No, logical conjecture is not sufficient for realizing the Supreme. And then the sutra continues by saying, because it is never conclusive. The word tarka, in its more technical sense, indicates the speculative process of sorting out a number of possible premises, imagining the consequences of each, and eliminating the obviously inappropriate ones. I want to prove that there is fire on the mountain. Why do I believe that? This? Because the air is getting warmer? No, that could be on account of the sun's coming out behind the clouds. Because there is smoke on the mountain? Well, if there wasn't any fire, then there wouldn't be any smoke. So you sort out and you decide, okay, let's try the premise that because there's smoke. Then you go ahead and build your argument. So tarka is used to decide what kind of argument you're going to try. This kind of educated guessing may be fruitful within a limited range of logically analyzable situations, but it can never enter the materially immeasurable range of transcendence. As stated in the Katha Upanishad, Naisha tarkina matir apaneya proktanina suganaya preshta. My dear boy, this understanding cannot be attained by tarka. To be realizable as spiritual truth, it must be spoken by someone with special authority. Tarka also has a more general sense. It just means logic in general. In the verse cited from the Mahabharata. Achintya kaluye bhava natams tarkena yojayet. Achintya means inconceivable, in the sense that things of a higher transcendental nature are impossible to explain materially. It doesn't mean that you can't understand them at all, or that you can't explain them at all, but you can't understand or explain them by ordinary material means. Therefore, they're achintya. Among the things, bhava, of this inconceivable spiritual nature are the Supreme Lord's personal qualities and his playful activities. These are ways, there are ways to know these, but Tarka is not one of them. Having cited these negative opinions, Sri Jiva gives the next three statements to show the positive alternative. Shastra Yoni Twat is the third of the Vedanta Sutras from the very first chapter. It resolves a doubt about how the object of devotional meditation, Lord Hari, is supposed to be found. Is it by one's own reason or by the direction of Scripture? Some may argue that according to the Upanishadic statement, the Upanishads say, Gotama Dhyayar Mantavya. Gotama and others realized him mentally. Logic is suitable for realizing the Lord, according to that statement. No, the sutra replies. Logic is not the means for knowing him, because Scripture is his so-called source. That doesn't mean that he was born in the womb of the Scripture, literally. Yoni literally means womb, and in this context, its significance signifies not the place of his generation, but the source of knowledge about him. Because God, the Absolute Truth, doesn't have a source, doesn't have a womb that he was born in. But knowledge about him is born in the womb of the Vedas. He is revealed in the Shastra, the Vedic scripture. This accords with an inquiry spoken in the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad, third chapter. Tam Aupanishadam Purusham Prichami. Aupanishadam. I want to ask about the Supreme Person who is known from the Upanishads. Shashutes to Shabda Mulatwad, also from the second chapter of Vedanta, comes from the same subchapter as Tarka Pratishtanat. Subchapter. Each chapter has four parts. So there's 16 parts in the Vedanta Sutra. Padas. Okay. Shrutes to Shabda Mulatwat. The argument is, Brahman is the creator of this world. But how does he avoid the fatigue and anxiety other creators suffer? He does so by creating everything simply by desiring. As stated in the Taittiriya Upanishad, so kamayata bahusham prajayeya. He desired, let me become many, let me create progeny. But how can the scriptures say something contradicted by our own experience? From experience, from our own direct perception, we know that creating is fatiguing and troublesome. And how can the scripture deny what we know from direct perception? Answer? Because revealed scripture, unlike sense perception, is based on Shabda Praman. Shrutes to Shabda Mulatwat. Shabda Praman alone verifies the authority of the Vedas. When other Pramanas contradict what the Vedas say, the contradictions are only apparent. Vedic Shruti is irrefutable. Then the verse beginning Pitra Deva Manushyanam was spoken by Uddhava, one of Lord Krishna's closest friends and advisors in the Yadu capital, Dwarka. Uddhava was a renowned Vedic scholar and the best student of Brihaspati, the teacher and priest of the demigods led by Indra. More important, however, Uddhava was an intimate devotee of Lord Krishna, trusted by him to convey personal messages to the gopis, grieving his absence from Vrindavan. For Krishna to have sent Uddhava to meet and talk with the gopis as his representative, Uddhava must have been competent to appreciate the most refined moods of love of God. Just before Lord Krishna ended his pastimes on earth, the Lord spoke extensively to Uddhava about the science of devotional service. These instructions are recorded as the Uddhava Gita in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. In this verse, Uddhava declares that the authority of the Vedas is superhuman because it is actually the authority of the Supreme Lord. Through the Vedas, the Lord reveals the deliberations of his own intelligence and offers the divine vision of his personal viewpoint to those willing to accept it. Okay, and then last, in the Sarvasamvadani, Sri Jiva Goswami deals with a number of technical matters about the perception of higher truth through language. He discusses why the teachings of the Vedas cannot be understood correctly by speculative methods. Why speculation in understanding the scripture is of subordinate utility. And how to deal with the contention by the Prabhakara school of Karma Mimamsa that the only authoritative and meaningful statements of the Vedas are those that enjoin duties. He discusses how to understand the different ways in which words express meaning, literally and figuratively. And he also discusses standard methods for interpreting scripture. Okay, but first, I have a question. So the Sarvasamvadani is optional. Should we read this or not? Anybody want to skip it? Okay. It's tough. It's going to be tough. Okay. Yes. Go ahead, yeah.
I have two questions. One of them is about the Vedanta Sutra, how it's not eternal. I'm just wondering, it's all based on the Upanishads and the Vedic statements, which are eternal, and it's obviously so useful for understanding them all. So why is it only just coming in one?
Okay, it's a shame it's not eternal.
Yeah.
But it technically isn't. Some other sage comes and writes a different Vedanta Sutra in different ages.
Okay, he might get a different interpretation.
Even the Panini Sutras are not eternal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. I mean, you could argue, why can't it be eternal? You know, they serve the purpose. Why do you have to get rid of them or replace them? That's just, I'm sorry, it's a material world. Things decay and get lost.
Uh-huh. And the other question is that somebody may argue reading this the fifth and sixth chapters of the first canto of the Bhagavatam that it seems like Narada Muni is giving instructions to tell Vyasadeva to write the Bhagavatam, and it's like it's the last thing on the list. All the other stuff's been done.
He didn't say write a book.
He said describe
the Lord's
Adi Ganyatam.
Yeah, glories and his avatars, his pastimes.
Yeah.
Meditate and then describe. Of course, he's asking Vyasadeva to describe it from his realization in his words. So it sounds like he's asking him to write a book. That's just apparent. Vyasadeva is the apparent author of the Bhagavatam. As a Purana, it should have an author. And Vyasadeva is obviously that author. But it's pretending to be an ordinary Purana. Just like Krishna is pretending to have a mother and father. That's part of his pastimes. You know, if you leave out Nanda, Yashoda, Devaki, and Vasudeva, then you're really missing something in Krishna's pastimes. You can't leave that out. That's an essential part of the pastimes. But in strict truth, he doesn't have any parents. So in strict truth, the Bhagavatam doesn't have any author. But if you leave out Vyasadeva as the, you know, the pastime author of the Bhagavatam, then you're missing something.
Right, yeah.
Actually, you can say that Krishna's having a parents is an illusion, but that illusion is the highest reality. The relationship between Krishna and his parents is more real than your so-called reality. Even though you call it illusion, okay, big philosopher, you can call it illusion,
But that illusion is the highest reality. It's the illusion created by Yogamaya. So you can say that also about Vyasadeva being the author of the Bhagavatam. It may be technically, you know, Vedantists may call it an illusion, or somebody may analyze it as, you know, Bhagavatam doesn't have an author.
But in the Leela, he's the author. And that Leela is the highest reality.
Okay, that's a nice answer. Where do we get this information that Vedanta Sutra and Mahabharata are eternal? Is it here in the Sandarbhas somewhere? Or where do we know that from?
Well, I'm sorry. They're not considered Shruti. Traditionally, Vedanta Sutra is not considered Shruti. It's a commentary on Shruti. It's actually the Prasthana Trayi would be Shruti, Smriti, and Nyaya. It's a separate category of logical argument. So it's not traditionally considered to be eternal. And there's no statement where it says it is eternal. We have argument given by Jiva Goswami that we don't find elsewhere that the Bhagavatam is eternal. But you won't find a similar argument that the Vedanta Sutra or the Mahabharata is eternal. Nobody's claiming that it is. Either one is. I mean, let him write something. He's editing every other book. Let him write a couple of books too. Sarvaka and then Bhagavata.
I don't remember exactly Sanskrit of this code, but it is said that Bharatam something like Bharatam Panchanam Vedanam is one of the codes.
Well, figuratively.
Is it?
It's the fifth Veda, but figuratively. First of all, there's only four Vedas. There aren't five. There aren't five Vedas, there are four Vedas. But figuratively, it's as good as the Vedas. For our purposes, it's better. So it gets the title of fifth Veda, but that's poetic title, it's not literal.
Not literal.
Because it's not a Veda, it's Mahabharata. It's not really a Veda. Gita Upanishad, but Gita is Gita. It's not really an Upanishad, not literally. I mean, there's 108 Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita is not on the list.
You explained that the Vedanta Sutra and Mahabharata are temporary, but in another place we heard that the Bhagavatam is the commentary on Vedanta Sutra. So how... how we can accept that the
Well, yeah, but there's so many things in the Bhagavatam that seem to be temporary, things that happened at certain times. This Bhagavatam seems to be connected with temporary time in a number of ways. But it's like that. It's a script written before the fact. It's a commentary on a book that hasn't been written yet. But also there'll be some Vedanta Sutra in every age, just somebody else writes a different Vedanta Sutra in other ages. Yes. I'm sorry, but okay. Okay, yeah, it's your turn. Yeah, I'm sorry.
If I'm not mistaken, I heard in one of your seminars on the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the underview, that Vedanta Sutra is just like a synopsis. In a sense, it's like notes on the original Vedas, which in a very short and succinct and sometimes very cryptic way explain the same eternal message of the Vedas, but in a Samanvaya form. So from that point of view, Srimad Bhagavatam could still make perfect sense as a commentary on that notes, on the notes of Vedavyas on the Vedas, explaining the original message of the Vedas, but deciphering his handwriting, deciphering his abbreviations things which he... So in other words, just like a... I think you mentioned that point that Vedas are so cryptic, and then in order to make them very clearly understood and preserved very short form as a point of reference, which would be always there as a standard proof of things, which could be a test stone for different philosophies, because they have to apply their own logic, their own principles on the Vedanta Sutra and make most sense out of it.
Yes.
That's the test for different philosophies and the schools of thought which come up. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is the key which Srila Vyasadeva himself gave for his own for his own.
But
scripture.
It's not a key that can be used by amateurs.
No,
it's for specialists.
It's the original reference point.
It's like Einstein's original, you know, paper on papers on relativity. You know, they're crucial. Modern physics is based on them, but only a few people can understand them.
Yeah. In other words, if somebody tries to understand Vedanta Sutra, which is a temporary scripture, in the sense that it was a temporary notes of synopsis of the original eternal scripture of the Vedas.
Yeah.
If they derive some other meanings rather than Bhagavatam, Bhagavatam explains very explicitly what the Vedanta Sutras really mean. If somebody explaining Vedanta Sutras arrives at a different conclusion, then he's wrong. So Srimad Bhagavatam serves as the ultimate reference point, the ultimate standard.
Yes. It's very difficult to come to a conclusion, to identify what conclusions the Vedanta Sutra is aiming at, because they're so cryptic. So Bhagavatam explains what the Vedanta Sutra is talking about. The Mayavadis take it their way. The devotees of Lord Shiva take it their way. Everyone's got a different take on the Vedanta Sutra.
That's why probably Vaishnavas didn't really comment on the Vedanta Sutra till Baladeva Vibhushana was challenged, and he had to write just to show logically to other people who didn't believe in us being authorized Sampradaya, how we make the most sense out of. In other words, he just extracted Srimad Bhagavatam basically from Vedanta Sutra in a roundabout way.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would put so much emphasis on Bhagavatam that he said, this is the natural commentary, we don't need to write another one at least for now. Other Sampradayas, they're very much into writing commentaries and commentaries on commentaries on Vedanta Sutra. You know, Baladeva Vibhushan wrote this Govinda Bhashya, very important book. Has anybody ever written a sub-commentary on it in Sanskrit? There isn't any. Nobody's bothered even to write a sub-commentary. Yes. Oh, he did, yes. Okay, anything else? Yes.
He explains Bhagavatam explains Vedanta Sutra even in a more elaborate manner. It means that like the sadhana and phala part of Vedanta Sutras, they're focusing only on meditational processes explained in Upanishads and the result of maximum liberation. Yes. They don't explain anything of love of God and other things.
Yes.
So Bhagavatam explains that and also stretches and goes to the highest point of the prema bhakti as the ultimate goal.
He does?
Is it?
Oh, you're asking. I thought so, but when I looked more closely, he doesn't go that much into it. He doesn't explain that explicitly and elaborately about the secrets of devotional service. He doesn't in the Govinda Bhashya. Okay. You think he should, or you hope he did. But actually, he just sticks to the main points. But it's not a very extent, you know, like a voluminous commentary. He's fairly brief, especially after the first five sections. Yeah, he does it from a transcendental point of view, but he doesn't try to make it a substitute for the Sandarbhas or the Bhaktivedanta Sindhu. Those books are already there, and we have the Bhagavatam. So he's not trying to make a substitute for the Bhagavatam. That's not necessary. So he doesn't explain everything that's in the Bhagavatam. He just deals with what the Vedanta Sutra is obviously talking about. There's a lot of things to explain just in that realm without trying to make it a complete treatise on pure devotional service. So he didn't do that.
But is it possible to extract such a deep meaning from...
Sit down and write a sub-commentary. And explained it all based on the Sandarbhas and on Bhagavatam. Do it. It can be done. It's got to be done by someone who knows Sanskrit. It should be done in Sanskrit first, then you can translate it. Should be done. I'm not going to do it, but someone should write a sub-commentary on the Govinda Bhashya. Okay? Yes, sir. Yes.
about Karma Mimamsa school, Prabhakara school. So
we'll get into that. Huh? We will be getting into that.
Oh, we'll be getting
it'll be explained in the Sarvasambhavani. Because this is just a brief outline of what the Sarvasambhavani is talking about.
Oh, I see. So
we're going to read the actual thing. What do you want to know?
It's a short question. So they, as far as I understand from here, they take only those statements of the Vedas which enjoin duties, and they explain all other statements as allegories or embellishments or things like that.
In general, all the followers of Jaimini himself did that. Mm-hmm. But there's three schools, two major schools, Kumari Labhattas and Prabhakaras. Prabhupada had one disciple in Jhansi, isn't it? He gave him the name Prabhakara Mishra. He named him after Prabhakara. They draw different conclusions. They sort of extend that fact that the important statements are those that give injunctions. They stretch that out to further corollaries in different ways. Prabhakara is even more extreme about it. We'll read about that.
The question is another question, that if in the Vedas there is any statement which enjoins taking them all literally. In other words, if there is such a statement in the Vedas,
the Vedas should be taken literally?
All of them. In other words, if there is such a statement, that it's a duty and they should follow it also and take all the Vedas literally. If there is such a statement.
But if you don't already believe that, you're not going to accept the statement. You're asking, you want to see the Vedas saying that the Vedas should be accepted in toto. But if you don't accept the Vedas in toto, the Vedas telling you to do that isn't going to make any difference. If you don't already accept them. You want the Vedas to declare their own authority. They do sometimes. I can't remember where.
In other words, that would be an argument against the school of thought. If there is such a statement in the Vedas...
Just like the last statement in the Shvetashvara to Upanishad. It's not so straightforward in that way, but you can deduce from it. It says, one who has faith, great faith in the Lord and his spiritual master, all the ideas that have been expressed here become actually realized. So here means this Upanishad. So it's implying that this Upanishad is revealing the absolute truth. So at least for one Upanishad, it's claiming to be a revelation of the absolute truth. And many other statements like that in Upanishads that what we're saying here is a revelation of the absolute truth. So in that way, at least piecemeal, the Vedas are claiming authority. Maybe not a statement that, all the Vedas do that. Maybe there is some statement. I can't think of one.
If it were, then it would be a very good argument against them because it's a duty and they skip it.
I see. It's an injunction. Believe the Vedas.
Yeah, that's what.
Yeah, but they're not disbelieving. They're just subordinating certain statements as not important. There's the important statements and then there's the unimportant supporting statements. It's not saying, they're not claiming that the statements are false or bogus or meaningless. It's just that the meaning is not essential.
But
he says anartakya, that it doesn't have significance, but it doesn't mean that the words don't mean anything. But all they are glorification or detailed explanation, which is not what Vedas are really about. It's just connecting tissue. The essence are the injunctions. But they're not saying that they're unauthoritative, just that they're not important.
Well, that's tantamount to saying that these are not authoritative.
Well, they're kind of. No, but it's like they don't tell you anything important. They're just decoration. It's not bogus decoration, but it's not telling you the important facts.
But they take the effect of an enjoyment or kind of sorry, not enjoyment.
Like, I'm giving a lecture and I say, you know, 50,000 times in my lecture. That's not a false statement. Hopefully you do know what I'm talking about. So I'm just making a true statement. You know. But it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. It doesn't make any difference. I bet I didn't say that 50,000 times. But it's not false. It's not unauthoritative. It's just inappropriate and irrelevant. Or not important.
Maybe it's an injunction.
Well, that's you should know.
You should know. just keep known as a Vidhi form. Anyway, I was just trying to look for that particular argument against their school of thought. Anyway, sorry.
Well, I never saw anybody do that. Argue with the Mimamsakas that the Vedas say you should believe everything the Vedas say, therefore you shouldn't look down on the... Okay, well, they know that they're supposed to, that the Vedas are authoritative, every single syllable of them. But they're not... Some of them are just not saying anything important. Yes? Oh, I think we don't have time to start it today. I thought it would be cleaner to start tomorrow. You want to do something right now? I'll read it, but I won't discuss it. I'll just read it for something to think about tomorrow, overnight. A short one? Go ahead.
About Vedanta Sutra, that it's a book which is written every millennium by Vyasadeva. So is there any descriptions what it should consist of? And
what
about Vedanta Sutra? Is there any information of what should be what it should consist of? Like some pattern of chapters? Because we can see that
there are descriptions in later textbooks that describe the Vedanta Sutra,
yeah,
especially in commentaries on Vedanta Sutra. But you want a pre-existing, before the Vedanta Sutra, a formula about what the Vedanta Sutra should be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
So it can be completely different books.
Format could be different, I think so. I don't think there's a formula, you know, ancient or eternal formula about what the Vedanta Sutra should be like. I don't think so.
Yeah. Because we have this mention that Srimad Bhagavatam is in commentary of Vedanta Sutra, so it must be some basic information.
But the Bhagavatam's explanation doesn't depend on the format. Bhagavatam is explaining the ideas, the philosophy. It's not dealing with individual sutras necessarily.
And also, I found one quote. It's from 3rd canto, 12th chapter, 39. I'll just read it quickly. Itihasa purana ni panchamam vedam ishvaraha sarvepya eva vaktepya sasrije sarvadarshinaha. It's about creation of this universe, and
yes,
it's creation by Brahma. Brahma. Then he created the fifth Veda, Puranas and the histories.
Same thing.
From all his mounts, since he could see all the past, present and future.
But again, that is not to be taken too literally. There are four Vedas. They're fifth Veda, called fifth Veda because they're as authoritative as the Vedas. That's all.
Yeah, but how to put together that it was created by Srila Vyasadeva? But we can see that in the very beginning it was created by Lord Brahma.
Oh, okay. I think it's getting late. It's getting late. I don't think we can get into a long discussion now. Musapam Vyasadeva edited the Vedas and re-spoke them, but they were there. The Shruti was there before the creation. So certainly when Brahma created the universe, he manifested the Vedas. And he also manifested the Smritis, okay.
Yeah.
But the Smritis that he manifested in the beginning are not necessarily exactly in the same form as the current Smritis.
Mm. Especially in the verse itself, it says Rije Sarva Darshanaha, and it's one who can see all time. And Srila Prabhupada explained that he could see all the past, present, and future, and therefore he created this Puranas and Mahabharata.
Okay, but
he
created the genre, and he created a set of Puranas, but we know, well, we're told that the Puranas can be changed. They can appear in different words, in different ages. So there may be thousands of different versions of each Purana from different ages. Did Brahma create all of those versions at once? Or did he create some version at the beginning of creation And then later on, someone else said it again in different words. I think that's a...
I can read Srila Prabhupada's commentary. There are histories of particular countries and nations and of the world, but the Puranas are the histories of the universe. Not only in one millennium, but in many kalpas, Brahma has knowledge of those historical facts, and therefore all the Puranas and histories as originally composed by Brahma, they are parts of the Vedas and are called the fifth Veda. So it seems that he knew all the kalpas and he...
Okay, I won't argue with that. And we're over time. We have other classes. We got to stop. Okay, sorry. You want the first paragraph. I'll just read the English. First paragraph of the Sarvasambandhini will start tomorrow. I'll read the first paragraph. Therefore, the Vedas are the authority, reliable in all matters and all respects. But since the Vedas consist of the words of the all-knowing Supreme Lord, finite living beings, who do not know everything, have difficulty figuring out what the Vedas mean. Only those who, by His power, the Supreme Lord's power, have received special perceptive capacity, are able in all circumstances to realize what the Vedas mean. Mental speculators are not able to do so. That's just the first paragraph. That's the easy part. We'll get into the difficult discussions after a few paragraphs. Okay, we'll stop here for now and continue tomorrow. We can continue this question about the Brahma speaking, the Puranas at the beginning of creation. We can deal with that tomorrow also. Okay. I'm saying the Puranas are not eternal. But he's saying that Brahma manifested the Puranas, you know, it said the Brahma manifested all the Puranas at the beginning of creation. Brahma doesn't make things out of nowhere, so that means they pre-existed.
And he
manifested, they must be eternal. Yeah.
And he did it along with all four Vedas and all Ayurveda. So
I'll tell you what,
at the same time,
Jiva Goswami has something to say about the status of the Puranas. Let's wait until we hear what Jiva Goswami has to say, and then we'll bring this discussion up again. That means we'll have to wait about 2 weeks. You know, we'll see what Jiva Goswami's opinion about whether the Puranas are eternal or not. She does say something about Lord Matsya manifesting eternal Purana, so we'll get to that. Thank you all. Glory to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.